Chapter 22. The burros, with their loads on their backs, waited patiently for Dobbs to kick them as a signal that it was time to shuffle off. Now and then they turned their heads toward Dobbs, hoping to get the few handfuls of corn they'd become used to since leaving the mine. Surely they were wondering why Dobbs didn't shout to them to be on their way, for they were accustomed to march the moment they felt that the packs were well tied to the saddle. Dobbs had more trouble loading them than he'd expected. It was not easy to pack burros properly without the help of another man. One man alone cannot pack two sides at the same time, at least not easily. With many oaths and kicks, Dobbs finally succeeded in his task, but much time had been lost, and it was now near noon. At the very moment he was just ready to march, he thought of Curtin. He had, of course, thought of Curtin scores of times during the morning, though not as a person, dead and gone for good. They had been together for such a long time that he thought of him as gone hunting or to the village to buy provisions. But now, for the first time during the morning, he realized fully that Curtin was dead. It came to him suddenly, as a shock. Had he not been alone with his thoughts, he might have completely forgotten Curtin in a few hours. Being alone in such a wilderness, however, he continually thought he heard Curtin's voice in a sneering laugh. He hesitated, then decided it might be better to leave the body where it was. Even should Indians come up this trail, the body was hidden so deep in the dense bush that it seemed most unlikely it would be discovered. Another thought sneaked into his troubled mind. Suppose he buried the body, and it should be found by dogs or by coal burners. Should this happen, it would be taken for evidence that the story he intended to tell could not be true. So he concluded to leave the body unburied, as that would look more as if Curtin had been killed by bandits, or had shot himself. Besides, if he left the body exposed, lions, tigers, wild pigs, buzzards, worms, and ants would do away with it so quickly that in a month it would be impossible to tell whose bones were bleaching in the bush. But then the rags of clothing and things Curtin carried in his pockets might tell more than the body would. Suddenly Dobbs noted that everything about him was silent. He had never taken any notice of the fact that nature in the tropics, as noon approaches, becomes drowsy and falls asleep. Birds cease to sing and no longer fly about. Insects become quiet and hide away under leaves and in other shady places. Squirrels are no longer seen, and greater animals seem to vanish as if chased away. Even the wind goes to sleep. The leaves no longer whisper. Dobbs felt this growing silence like something strange happening in the whole world. It seemed to him as though trees and leaves became petrified. Their color turned from green to a dull, dust-like gray. The air felt strangely heavy, and the atmosphere appeared to have turned into gaseous lava. Dobbs could see little of the sky because of the dense foliage above him, and the air seemed so thick that he could scarcely breathe. The mass of underbrush and the trunks of the trees seemed to close in on him and swallow up the last bit of air. Wherever he looked, all around him had turned gloomy, as though in a dream. Thick sweat broke out all over his body. He had the sensation that if he did not move that very second, he also might become petrified, like everything else around him. Fright came upon him. The burros were standing as though turned to stone. Trained to follow commands, they were waiting for their orders. With their large dark eyes, they stared at Dobbs without blinking. Dobbs, realizing that the eyes of the burros were resting unceasingly upon his face, became afraid of the animals. For a second, the idea struck him that these burros might be charmed human beings, knowing and understanding fully what he had done, and ready to accuse him, spring at him, and kill him. He shook off this idea and tried to grin at it, but he could not. He stepped over to the burros and worked about their packs, trying a rope here, fixing a twisted strap there, and pulling at the packs and saddles to see that they were tight for the trip. He pushed the animals around and pressed his fist into their flesh to assure himself that they were alive. After that, he felt easier. But this feeling of relief did not last long. When he caught one burro staring at him again with its large eyes, he thought that perhaps Curtin might glare at him with eyes exactly like those of the animals. Anyway, I think it's safer by all means to bury him, but I can't look at his eyes. I might never forget him. Yet I never bothered about the staring eyes of the dead Heinies. How was that? Well, no other way out. I have to dig him in. It's better to do that. He pulled a spade out of one of the packs. When he had it in his hands, he again became undecided. Should he dig that carcass in, or would it be a waste of time? Hadn't he better hurry and get the burrows going and try to reach the railroad station as soon as possible? He pushed the spade back into the pack, and as he did so, he became suddenly curious to see if the buzzards had already started to feast upon the body. To know this before he left the place would give him a welcome feeling of security. So he pulled out the spade once more, threw it over his shoulder, and went resolutely into the bush. He walked straight to the spot where Curtin's body lay. He could have found the spot with both eyes closed. He was sure he would be able to find it as easily 50 years hence. But when he got there, the place was empty. He knew that he had erred in the direction. The darkness of the night and the uncertain flicker of the campfire and of the burning torch in his hand had confused him. Nervously, he began to look for the body. He crawled through the underbrush, pushing hastily through the branches of shrubs, spreading open the foliage, glancing left and right, and becoming more nervous every second. He feared that he might come upon the body unexpectedly, and that it would give him a shock which would break him. So he decided not to search any longer, but to hurry back to the burrows and march off as quickly as possible. Halfway back, he realized that he would never find peace if he left without seeing the corpse and making sure that the job had been done well. Again, he began to search. He ran about this way and that in the bush. The more he ran, the more confused he became. He hurried back a dozen times to where the camp had been last night to take up the direction afresh. But now he could not recall precisely the direction into which he had driven Curtin. It was all in vain. He could not find the body. For a minute, he rested to get his head clear and to concentrate on the direction. His nervousness made him tremble. The sun was now straight above him in the sky, and its heat penetrated the crowns of the trees. He felt the sun scorching his brain. He panted and cursed himself. He was bathed in sweat. Down he went on his knees by the little brook near the camp and lapped up the water like a thirsty dog. Then, kneeling there for a few seconds, he felt that his thoughts were going to run amok. Searching again through the brush and crawling along the ground covered with low prickly plants, he turned his head nervously from side to side. He tried to convince himself that it was not fear that tortured him, that it was nothing but the heat and exhaustion. Without forming words, he babbled to himself that he was not afraid, that he was afraid of nothing, that he was only excited by the aimless running about and the vain search. Hell, he must be here. He couldn't have flown away. He cried out, breathlessly. In the deep silence of the bush, he heard his own voice, as if it were the voice of somebody hidden behind the foliage. And his voice frightened him, as no man's voice had ever frightened him in his life. The burrows showed an increasing restlessness. The leader started to march off. Soon the whole train was underway, following him. Perhaps they smelled a good pasture ahead. With an oath, Dobbs sprang after the burrows. This confused and frightened them, and they began to run. He had to run faster and faster to overtake the lead and stop the train. Panting and nearly breaking down, he drove the animals back to the camp. They stood quiet for a while, nibbling at their sparse grass. Then two of the burros looked at him with their great black eyes without moving their heads, and Dobbs felt as if they were trying to search his mind. This frightened him more than ever. For a second he thought he would blindfold them to be safe from these terrifying looks, but his thoughts wandered away from this intention before he had taken a step toward the burros.
"Gee cries! Where the hell is that damn guy?"
he gasped and wiped his face with his sleeve. Once more he began to search the bush. He was for the 100th time convinced that he must be on the very spot where he'd shot Curtin. He noticed a piece of the charred torch from which he had lighted up the place the night before when he went back to give his victim another shot. This charred piece of wood left no doubt any longer that this was the place where he had shot Curtin. The ground was disturbed, but that might easily have been caused by his running about. There was no trace of blood.
"Where under heaven is the body?"
he asked himself. Perhaps a tiger or wild pigs had dragged it to where they could eat it in peace. He stood, thinking. Nothing better than that could have happened. He said aloud, looking at the ground, "Very soon not even a bone will be left to tell the tale. Done as if by order. It's almost too perfect to believe." With a satisfied feeling, Dobbs walked slowly back to the camp. The burros, the pack still on their backs, had laid down on the ground. Dobbs was so quiet that he now could take out his pipe, fill it, and have a smoke. He thought seriously about getting started. When he was ready to make off, he again felt slight shivers running up and down his back. The sweat on his body seemed to turn to ice. He buttoned up his shirt almost to the neck. He shook himself, as if to pull himself together resolutely. He shouted at the burros to get up. The train was once more on its way. Dobbs found the march more difficult than he had expected. If he marched ahead, the burros in the rear strayed off looking for food. He had to stop the train, go back, and bring up the rear. If he marched behind the last animal, the leader either stopped or went off the trail, or lay down. He had to run up and down the train like a dog, keeping a flock of sheep together. He tried tying a rope around the neck of each burro and fastening it to the saddle of the burro ahead. The animals could only march single file, as the trail was not wide enough to let them go side by side. Leading them by ropes did not help much. If a burro at the rear stopped, he would pull so hard at the rope that the burro ahead of him would also stop, and so the whole train would come to a standstill. Dobbs tried again without ropes, leaving the burros free to march as best they could. He found that this worked best. Once they were well on their way, all Dobbs had to do was to call occasionally, to let them know that he was still there, ready to whip them, should they lag. He took out his pipe and had another smoke. He walked now leisurely, behind the train. The leisure, though, made his mind wander again. "I should have looked around more carefully. And hell, come to think of it, I didn't see his gun I threw upon him after the last shot." He touched his hip. "I've got my own gun, all right, but not his. How is that? Perhaps he was not dead at all, only badly hurt. He may have come to. Perhaps he's crawling through the bush farther and farther away. If he should reach an Indian village, he might get help. What then? What would I do then?" He turned round, stopped, and listened. He thought that the Indians had found Curtin and were already after him on horseback. Whatever he did and whichever way he went, he can't be in a village yet. The nearest one must be at least 10 miles from that place. He couldn't make that in one day, hurt as he is. I better go back and find him, cost what it may. I simply have to find him. Otherwise, I may get 20 years on the Maria Islands. It's a hell of a place, they say. Not so good. He concluded that there was no way out but to go back and look once more. This time, more thoroughly. He remembered that there was one direction he had failed to cover completely. It might be just there where he would find Curtin, dead or still alive. He was sure that he would find him there. It was almost dark when Dobbs got back to the camp. He did not bother to unload the burros just then. He could do that after nightfall. He had to use the last light of the day for his search, so he went straight at his task. Although he had made up his mind, while marching back, to look less hastily than he had in the forenoon, he began to search just as nervously as before. He could not force himself into a disciplined, calm exploration. Night fell quickly, too quickly for Dobbs. He had to return to the campsite. There he unloaded the burros and lighted a fire. He was too weary to cook much food. All he had was coffee and a few tortillas that were about to turn musty. Thinking things over, he decided that he could not waste 1 hour more on the search for the body. Next morning, he would leave at the first glimpse of light. He would try his utmost to reach Durango inside of 2 or 3 days. There, he would sell the burros, the tools, and the hides for any price offered, just to get cash. Then he would take the train, and, instead of going to the port, he would take the shortest route north and cross the international line before Howard could hear what had happened and wire a description of him to the border stations. Dobbs remembered now that he was already on the eastern slope of the Sierra Madre, and that yesterday he and Curtin, standing on a high, bare rock, had seen the smoke of a passing train far away.